Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Where, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the podcast, I have the pleasure of speaking with Sana Javeri Qadri, the founder and CEO of the direct trade spice company, Diaspora. Starting with just one spice in 2017, Sana set out to create a radically equitable, sustainable, and more delicious spice supply chain. After selling out of product from the company's first turmeric harvest in just 3 hours, Diaspora was immediately on track to national acclaim. Now, by the end of 2021, Sana aims to have 30 spices available on Diaspora, putting equitable wages and power directly into the hands of roughly 150 farm partners and 1,000 farm workers across India. Diaspora's direct supply chain also means deeply flavorful and aromatic spices that are coveted by both professional chefs and home cooks alike and are available both direct to consumer and in specialty retailers around the country. But back before Sana was envisioning a new standard for what an equitable food system looks like, she worked in many other facets of that system, from farm worker to line cook, to marketing consultant to photographer, Sana's many experiences positioned her to found Diaspora at the age of 24. I can't wait to bring you through it all. Now, on Second Life, it's Sana Javeri Qadri. All right, Sana, are you ready to start at the beginning?
I am, yes.
Okay, good. So we like to take it way back. And I'm curious, what did you study in school and what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, so I definitely went through the phase like everybody else where I wanted to be a spy when I grew up. But I think...
I love that you are so accurate in that. I blame Harriet.
Yes, there's like a third grade moment that it happens at. But I think from then onwards, I was really, from sixth grade onwards, I was really fascinated by consumption. And as a result, the one thing that captured or studied consumption was economics. And so I really thought that there was some job for me in economics because I loved understanding demand and supply. And I loved those graphs. And I thought that I would study economics at school, but then went on this agricultural detour and ended up studying visual arts and food studies in college. And that was because I went to this wild, woo-woo, magical high school called the United World Colleges, which is 200 people from 100 different countries. Everybody's on scholarship. And the focus of the school is educating students for peace and a sustainable future. And it was set on the Adriatic Sea, on the limestone cliffs of the Rilke Path. So like the most dramatic, beautiful location. And I spent a lot of my time in my 2 years in high school there, working on an on-campus farm and spending a spring on a vineyard and an olive grove. So that really changed the course of what I was thinking about and interested in as before that, you know, a city Mumbai girl who thought that vegetables grew at the grocery store. And yeah, I went into college knowing that I wanted to find some place for myself in food.
Wow. Okay, so you started working at a really young age then, if you're working in school on the campus organic farm and you're baking at Walker Coffee House. Tell me a little bit about those experiences, and did you feel like you were uncovering anything about yourself during that time?
Yeah. So my first week of college, and, you know, I went to Pomona College, which is this small liberal arts college on the West Coast outside LA. And my first week, we have this thing called orientation adventure, where they send you on a hiking trip or a kayaking trip or something with a few other freshmen in order to experience and, I don't know, get to know each other. And for me, it was my first real time visiting the United States and now moving to the United States. So there was a lot of culture shock that first week for me. And we went on this like kayaking trip with five other people, and I was just miserable. I think it was too much too soon. I cried the entire trip. I don't think I made any friends on that trip, but I did have one of the kind of supervisors who was a senior at the time. And she said, you know, if you're going to take anything out of your time here, get interesting experiences. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And she was like, well, you could get a job like at the campus gym and, you know, sit there and do your homework, or you could get a job at the dining hall, and that's fine. And you'll earn good financial aid money or student wages. But why not use all the opportunities that this incredibly privileged place gives us to learn interesting things? And she was telling me about how she worked at the on-campus radio station, and then she also worked at the on-campus farm. And I mean, my eyes were just getting wider and wider, because I certainly didn't know that all of these things existed and that they would actually pay you to do these things. So I think I took Gabby, who is still a good friend, her advice very to heart. And I set about saying, I want to know about the food system, but I'm currently existing in this liberal arts bubble in the middle of the desert in Southern California. So how can I use the opportunities available on this campus to A, learn about the food system to the best of my ability, but then also to learn about America? Because I think I was so confused about where I had landed. You know, this accent that you're hearing is from watching a lot of American television growing up, but I was born and raised in Mumbai. So I ended up working on our on-campus organic farm, which was really the anchor of my 4 years in college, and also working at Walker Coffee House, which is an on-campus bakery, where they gave me completely free rein. So it meant that if I wanted to make like gluten-free vegan cheesecakes one day, that was fine. I just had to go, you know, order the ingredients for those things, and I could offer it up on a Thursday. So I'm such a product of my environment and the educational opportunities I think I was really, really lucky to be given. And yeah, Pomona and my time there was really formative.
I love that. So it sounds like you had a really incredible time at school, but you also took a little time off. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, you know, coming to the US, I always joke that I understood the most about America by just roaming the grocery stores. Like I would go to Trader Joe's and be like, why are there so many snacks? Like, why is this necessary? So I was learning so much about this new country, like all my fellow international students, you know, we were such a little merry band of angsty diaspora kids. And I think that knowing that I wanted to work in the food system, but only learning about it academically, I just felt like I wasn't getting the education in the actual food industry that I needed to survive once I left this very privileged magical bubble. And I was just starting to feel a lot of culture shock, a lot of homesickness. I left Mumbai at 16, so I wanted to be in a big city. And, you know, I think as a young person, there is this idea that like you can go to New York and make it, which sounded very romantic at the time. And then I got to New York City and realized that my rent in a basement apartment in Crown Heights was going to be $850. And, you know, shit got real very quickly.
Yeah. So you had a ton of jobs during that time. Can you tell me a little bit about what you were doing, and more importantly, what you were loving and learning and what you did not like?
Yeah, I think moving to New York is where I learned one of the skills that has really served me in the past decade, which is if you write a thoughtful enough, professional enough sounding email to a fellow woman in the food industry who you want advice from, she will help you. And I wrote 20, 25 emails to women across the food industry in New York that I wanted to work with, that I wanted to get coffee with, that I was willing to take photos for, anything in order to get a conversation with them. And one of the many women that responded to me was Annie Novak of Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, who's now a dear friend and mentor. So she was very kind to let me come apprentice with her that summer, the summer of, I think it was 2014. But unfortunately, an apprenticeship in an urban farm in Brooklyn is very unpaid. So I was going to Eagle Street in the mornings, which was so exciting, mostly because I think Annie was a force. And for me to see powerful, confident women running shit was really impactful. And then I would go waitress at Basil, which was literally the only fancy restaurant that was in my Crown Heights neighborhood. I definitely did not know that it was a Hasidic Jewish restaurant when I applied. And I also didn't know that I would be the only non-Jewish, like, brown person in the entire organization. And I have, to this day, no idea why they hired me. And I have no waitressing experience to my name. You know, I think the first night, Clara, my boss at the time, said that she was planning to send me home within 3 hours and I wouldn't have the job anymore. But somebody, a kid, started screaming and dropped his water. And I think an instinct jumped into me of, like, fix this, make the kid stop crying, and then just fix everything else that comes your way. And eventually she didn't send me home and she called me back. And I spent, yeah, a lot of, I don't think they knew that I was 19 because I was serving liquor. And I didn't understand anything about Hasidic Jewish culture. You know, I was very new to America. So this is a very specific subset of Brooklyn culture. So big learning curves. But I think I got a crash course on race during my time at Basil, where it was the first time that I was distinctly aware that the kitchen and back of house is black and brown and underpaid. And then upstairs, front of house, is usually white, or in this case, I suppose Jewish, and looked very different. And there was a clear divide. And weirdly, as an Indian South Asian woman who, I guess, is sometimes ethnically ambiguous, I was straddling both worlds without understanding the context of race for either of them. So it was a complicated time of understanding how race and politics and identity intersect within the food industry. Eventually, I think I tired of Basil and just couldn't handle the climate of race in that kitchen. And so I started baking at Ovenly for a brief time and then needed multiple temp jobs because I wasn't making $200 a night in tips anymore. So, you know, I think I pulled a few shifts at Mast Brothers. I tried to be the Van Leeuwen delivery driver, even though I didn't have a driver's license. Oh, I was God. Just hustling. And after, I think it was by August that I wrote a very morose email to the dean of, like, student affairs at Pomona and said, you know, I would really like to come back. Please accept me. I really miss being fed 3 meals a day in a dining hall and, like, my full-time job being reading academic texts about food justice.
Well, that gives you some perspective, right?
It does. It does. It was a good rude awakening for me of how good I had it in college.
So you went back to school and ended up starting the Claremont Food Justice Summit. Could you please walk me through the idea behind the summit and the logistics of putting it together? Because I am fascinated.
Yeah. In retrospect, I do think of it as a little bit of a scam, which is that, like, I wanted to network with all of these people in the food industry. And I basically used Pomona's resources to pay them to come to me.
So, I mean, that sounds like a wonderful scam, if it's a scam at all. It's just using the system.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think I went back to school knowing that I wanted to use my 2 years as productively as possible. You know, I was acutely aware that for my parents, an American education at such an elite institution was their life savings that they were putting into giving me this opportunity. And I wanted to make it count and I wanted it to mean something. So my idea was, this will give me every tool possible and access to every person possible so that I can graduate out of here with a plan and with somewhere to go. So I schemed up the Claremont Food Justice Summit, and my hope was is that it would really be a conference at the intersection of everything that food brought together, politics, history, cooking, feminism, Asian American studies, and have food be the lens through which we look at culture at large. And it's funny to talk about that now because that's exactly what my company does in such a different way. But the first year, I think we had a full week of speakers. And so we had over 50 speakers from all over the country that we were able to fly in and pay great honorariums to. I think I begged every student group to give me funding and somehow they obliged.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing.
Finally, I think I had to pay one honorarium of $3,000 that I just couldn't afford. It was for Nicolette Nyman, I think, like of Nyman Ranch.
What?
And I didn't have the cash for it. And so I went to the president of Pomona and I said, I need to bring this woman here. It's a perspective that's really important. Can you fund it? And he agreed, I think just out of shock.
Sana, this is amazing.
It was a lot of fun. So I did that my junior and senior year. I think around 2016, 2015 was when a lot of the first conversations, at least for me, around Black Lives Matter were starting to happen. So, you know, the inkling around, in my experience, had been happening around race and the food system was being given words in 2015, 2016. Like I didn't have the words in 2014. And I was now being given those tools and words through the Black Lives Matter movement, obviously from the perspective of a non-Black person. And I wanted somebody to do a training of what does food justice mean from a racial justice lens? Like, what does that look like? Because so often food justice conversations can be a very white spaces and very much around, you know, veganism, organic, small scale organic farming. And like, because land ownership in the United States is largely by white families, the organic farming movement is, you know, a very white movement. And I was given the name of this man called Saqib Kewal, and I connected with him and just felt an instant kinship. Like so much of what he was doing was putting names to things that I had been thinking about. And he was running something called, he was the co-founder of something called the People's Kitchen Collective with Sita Bhalmik and Jocelyn Jackson. And I invited him to come give a keynote speech. And he didn't at that point tell me that Sita Bhalmik was his, you know, co-founder and business partner. And he kind of upsold her to me and was like, oh, this fantastic artist, Sita Bhalmik, can do a chai workshop for you and talk about the history of chai. And at the time, my thesis was about the history of chai. So I was like, yes, absolutely. And then, you know, they showed up together and I realized that they were business partners and basically we'd found a way to pay them triple, which was great. And Sita's workshop ended up being the most popular workshop of the weekend, where she actually did a demonstration of how to make chai and like talked about the history of chai through that demonstration. And 5 years later, it's actually a demonstration that she taught me how to lead and that I have led a few times. So we have come a long way since, which I'm kind of giving away. But my visit with them had a real mark on me, where they seemed to be these like young, brown, queer folks living in Oakland, like hosting these radical dinners. Like it just seemed so hip and glamorous and cool and political. You know, I met them March 2016 and I was graduating in May with zero plan. And so in May, I emailed Sita saying, hey, I'm thinking of moving up to the Bay Area, which was a lie. I had no such plans. Can I come intern for you? And she said, sure, send me like a portfolio of what you think you can do for us. And I sent her a lot of my photographs and she said, actually, I'd like to hire you. Do you want to come be our photographer? I didn't bother to ask the rate. I didn't bother to ask how often she would need me. I just packed my car and drove up and said, great, I live in Oakland now.
What were you doing? What was it like? I mean, it's amazing that you just went. I think that's fabulous.
I mean, I guess that's the benefit of being 22 and, you know, have all your possessions fit in your ratty little Subaru. I had also recently come out, you know, and as a 22-year-old, for me, I had come out quite late in life and I knew of the Bay Area as like the queer place. And, you know, mm-hmm. I dreamt about the Castro. So there was a lot of things calling me to Oakland at the time. But I got here and I also interviewed for a job at Buyrite, which is a wonderful, you know, very farm-centric grocery store in San Francisco.
With amazing ice cream also.
Also with fantastic ice cream, which was such a perk of the job, and the most beautiful produce that I had ever seen. So I ended up getting a marketing assistant job there, which also was like a full circle moment, because back in 2014, when I was on my time off from school, I had read about this woman called Shakira Simley, who seemed from the internet like a fantastic figure. She was like the community manager at Buyrite, and she was also a canner who made these beautiful jams. And I loved the way that she was weaving together community, food justice, and, you know, something as hands-on as canning. Mm-hmm. And I had at the back of my mind that like someday I'll meet her and she'll mentor me. And sure enough, working on the marketing team at Buyrite, I would be on the same team as her, and she was at my interview. So it was really like, I have to work here. I don't care what it takes. I will work here. And luckily, Annie Novak of Eagle Street Rooftop Farm called the owner of Buyrite Market and said, if you don't hire Sana, you'd be making a big mistake. And I was like, thank you, Annie.
A summer well spent with that recommendation.
Seriously, yeah. All that watering paid off.
So wait, what was a marketing position? I mean, even at Buyrite, like, what did that entail? Did you like it? Was it interesting?
Yeah. You know, in a lot of ways, it took what I studied in college, which was visual art with a focus on photography. I've been photographing since my mom taught me on her film camera when I was 15. So it was putting together photography with food studies and food marketing. And so a lot of what I ended up doing was running the social media, writing the internal, there was a marketing coordinator and a marketing manager. So I was, you know, lowest of the totem pole, which I didn't mind at all at the time. It was my first job out of college. I was grateful for anything. And it was also a lot of photographing the produce, which I had a blast doing. I mean, my job was to take photos of oranges and citrus. Like, how wild is that? But I think over time, like over the course of those 6 months, I started to realize that what mattered to me and what I loved so much about my time in college is that you could tell complicated, deep stories about food, and food marketing as I knew it at my time at Buyrite, maybe as the cultural discourse in 2016 allowed, was very flat, you know? Like, if you wanted to tell the story of California citrus, you just had to show how beautiful California citrus was. That was the story. Whereas the story that I wanted to tell, and it was something that I had studied in college, which was that most of the citrus groves in Southern California were tended to by Chinese immigrant labor that was brought to work on the railroad and indigenous labor. And so really this whole myth of California citrus was a myth that was cared for and tended to literally by immigrants and by indigenous peoples. But that story was erased. Like, there's this equation of like gold rush, citrus, white people, California. And even in terms of the fact that some of the best citrus right now is grown on Japanese American farms, and those farms had to deal with a great injustice during internment. So there were all of these stories that I wanted to tell, and food marketing didn't feel like the right home for it, but it was the only place that paid your rent.
Not the most nuanced place for the full spectrum of this really interesting and important storytelling.
Exactly. So I think I was starting to realize that I wanted to be freelance, maybe as a photographer, maybe, you know, do more photojournalism. And this was around the same time that, segueing perfectly into chapter 3, that the turmeric latte trend was really exploding. Mm-hmm. And that's where I also wanted to be able to tell a much more complicated story around who's growing turmeric for these turmeric lattes. Where is it coming from? People are saying it's coming from India, but nobody seems to know where. So yeah, I was itching for something deeper and more complicated, but I didn't know how to make that commercially viable with living a very expensive life in the Bay Area at the time.
So what did you do? What were your next steps? And also, how in the world did you then make the leap to starting your own company?
It was a big leap. I think so. Trump was elected in 2016. And I think for me, when you're coming of age, when you're an immigrant, when you're a queer person, when you're a brown person, who this was my first real American election that I was experiencing, as an adult, it devastated me and I didn't feel welcome anymore. I didn't feel that my last name, you know, the Muslim ban happened February 2017. And as somebody with a Muslim last name, it hurt. And I didn't want to be here anymore. I didn't feel that it was a welcoming place for me. So I had this little inkling of an idea at the back of my head that I want to go photograph turmeric farms. So I ended up I quit my job in February of 2017, and I bought a one-way ticket back home to Mumbai, thinking that, you know, I'll figure it out. I'll freelance, I'll take photos, I'll go research this turmeric story. I had a tentative email from Roads and Kingdoms saying that they would maybe publish my story if I photographed these farms, like maybe. And I moved home and started applying my trick that had worked so well in America, which was writing these, you know, very eloquent emails to farmers, to anybody that I saw on the internet that was based in India and working in spices or turmeric, hoping to get access and get an in so that I could visit some of these farms. And, you know, February turned to March, March turned to April, April turned to May, May turned to June, and I had gotten no responses. I had done a lot of research. Like, I think I had downloaded the entire varietal history of turmeric over the past 150 years into my brain because I was refreshing the Indian Institute of Spices Research website so frequently.
Wow.
But I was not getting responses from people. No, everybody was ghosting me. And so I started flying places without being invited.
And what?
I just started this. Showing up.
I mean, that's one way to get your foot in the door.
Yeah. I mean, if you show up, how mean can they be? Yes, some people were mean. Like, there were two farms and like one export company that definitely showed me the door and said, please don't come back. But there were enough that didn't do that. And on that first on a whim trip that in retrospect, I'm like, wow, I had so much faith in myself to buy these plane tickets and, you know, spend 3 days driving all over Kerala, visiting farms and spice export companies. And that last stop, which was the Indian Institute of Spices Research, was, I think, the stop that changed the trajectory of my life. Dr. Preseth, who is now a good friend and colleague, took me to meet Dr. Nirmal Babu, who was the director at the time. And they were very excited and open. And they really just gave me a complete education on the history of the spice trade, on how colonialism gave way to kind of big ag and like industrial agriculture that continued to perpetuate injustice against like farmers growing spices and really only support traders. And then they also taught me about how most indigenous heirloom varieties of spices were not available on the open market. And like the varieties that were being commercially sold were either several varieties lumped together based on color, or, you know, varieties that were bred just for yield and size rather than flavor.
Wow.
Yeah, and they were so generous with their time. I mean, I think about that afternoon all the time where they sat with this 22-year-old girl and like taught her about the spice trade for 3 hours. And yeah, that was the beginning, I suppose.
So how do you go from visiting farms to starting your own direct trade spice company?
Yeah, I think talking to Dr. Preseth, he planted the seed where he said, look, we have access to farmers. Like, farmers come to us every day asking for a better market and asking for, you know, a market that appreciates the way that they're growing, that appreciates the quality of their product. And then we have the scientific know-how, the resources around testing. But what we don't have is access to market and access to traders or businesses that are willing to then market. So are you interested? Like, why don't you do that? And I totally felt honored that these like very distinguished, esteemed scientists were looking at this young kid and saying, you should do that. You can solve our problems. And I think in retrospect, he baited me a little bit and I totally fell for it. And I was like, okay, yes, I will do this for my country. I agree. And I didn't have a plan. I didn't have money. I didn't have any of these things, but I did have my 2016 tax refund to my name, which for those that don't know, the year that you go from being full-time in school for half the year and then full-time working for half the year, for the half the year that you were working, you're taxed as though you worked all year. That means that for that tax year, you get your biggest refund ever. And for me, $3,000 was like big time money. So my thought was, well, let me see how much turmeric I could buy with that $3,000. And maybe there's like 10 or 15 chefs in the Bay Area that I could sell it to. I felt like for my time at Bayreuth, I had enough connections that, especially if I, you know, say I bought 100 kilograms, I could just break it up into 10 packages and sell it to 10 people. And I shot off a couple emails to John Beaver, who's the wonderful human behind Oaktown Spice, which is like the Bay Area's premier spice shop, to Gold, which is a turmeric latte company that ended up becoming our first wholesale partner. And Gold is now this incredible company led by Trinity. So I shot off emails to them, and all of them responded really excitedly saying, we've been looking for this level of traceability. Like John Beaver, the man who ran this spice company or spice shop, said, I don't know the answers to any of the questions that you're asking me, but if you find something good, I'll buy it from you. And I was like, oh,
wow.
Okay. You'll buy it from me? So that was enough. I mean, I was like, what else am I going to do with this $3,000? I might as well buy some turmeric and see how much I can sell it for. I didn't have an understanding of how I was going to package it, of what margins were, what cost of goods were. Like, none of these things meant anything to me. But I did like the idea that there was this farmer, which kind of what I skipped over is that Dr. Prasad had introduced me to Mr. Prabhu Kasaranini at the time, who was this equally young, idealistic, wide-eyed farmer in Andhra Pradesh who had been growing an heirloom variety of turmeric called Pragati turmeric for a couple years and was looking for a better market for it. And the first time we got on the phone, one of the first things that he said to me was, if you don't care about how I take care of my soil, you're not the right buyer for me. And I was immediately like,
kismet.
Yeah, you're it. I love you. Take all my money. And I flew to see him like a day later. So, you know, I'd met up with him. I wanted to support him. I felt like his dream and mine were very connected and in line. And then our partnership grew over time, where I realized that he had the capacity to grow a lot more. And I had collected turmeric samples from all over the country. And his, by, you know, divine intervention, was more delicious, was brighter, was more colorful, had more aromatic notes than any of the other samples I'd received. So it seemed like a no-brainer that I would buy it and figure out what I would do after that. So in August of 2017, I moved back to the U.S. I knew that I had to keep my overhead really low. So I moved into a 12-person queer co-op.
Wow.
Which was such a messy idea. And started filling turmeric jars in the basement of the co-op, and was also photographing freelance somewhat, and also working front of house, back of house, all parts of house at Cosecha, which is kind of my neighborhood Oakland Mexican restaurant that I love dearly.
So how did you come up with a name? What was launch like? How did you build a website? Please explain some of these specifics to me, because this is so romantic, but I also am interested in like the nitty gritty of it.
Yeah. You know, I think it's very important for people to know that like we looked pretty scrappy and like not great for the first 2 years. I built a Squarespace website. I like, you know, placed the blocks and like put some photos in our packaging. I had worked with my dear friend Sophie Peoples at Bayreuth. She was the graphic designer and she was kind of my work wife. And we developed a visual language together where, you know, she knew what I wanted from a brand without even me having to really explain it to her. I think she came up with the logo in like 2 days. So I roped her into this and said, I need you to make Diaspora a reality and make it look good. And she immediately identified that we were going to make it be pink and yellow and orange and bright and fun. So some parts of it fell together very quickly because I had been thinking about, you know, how I wanted to represent my culture, how I wanted to tell stories about India for a long time, like literally for about a decade at that point. But then other parts, like when I look back at that first round of our packaging, it was terrible. We just had mason jars with stickers on top.
I mean, but it worked.
It worked. Yeah. I mean, I'm really surprised people took us seriously, and they did. So I built a Squarespace website. The bit that I kind of glossed over is that there were three very challenging months from June to August where I was trying to set up an export company in India. And that was like pulling teeth because there's so much paperwork involved and I didn't understand any of it. I kept making checklists and then tearing them up because I had all the wrong information. And like, I'm still surprised that we were able to make it happen. I definitely left for the US in August unsure whether I had an export company or not. Like I was like, I think I filed all the things so that we're a business, but also we might not be. So let's just send a shipment and we'll figure it out whether we are or not. Luckily we were. So there was so much naivety and like, if I had to do it all over again, knowing everything I know now, I would have had a lot more fear and would have strived for it to be more perfect than it was at the time. I think that's a good lesson that like, it doesn't have to be perfect. You just have to start.
You just have to start. That's true. So tell me about launch day.
Yeah, I remember the day because I was on a date with Rosie, my partner, and we went and got pizza bagels. And I said, you know, I need cash in order to buy more packaging. So I think I need to set up the Turmeric for pre-order. And she's like, what does pre-order mean? And I was like, basically, people will give me their money ahead of time before I can give them anything. And she was like, nobody's going to do that. And I was like, you know, you're probably right. Nobody's going to do that. But we tried anyway, because I needed cash. And so it wasn't even the janky jars. It was these giant bags. I think it was like almost a pound of turmeric is the only size that you could buy. And I posted on Instagram and I said, you know, I'm doing this project that I think is dedicated to decolonizing the spice trade. It's a small beginning, but we have really big dreams and you can buy some turmeric to support us. And we sold out within hours of this pre-order. And I was just shocked. And I know that it was some very, very kind friends who to this day are still working through the turmeric that they pre-ordered from me back then. But it happened. And it was also, I think, really the push that I needed to know that the internet and people were excited about this idea of more thoughtfully sourced spices and that it might be just turmeric and we might have just started with one spice, but the excitement for it was there.
So the first 2 years, you were still working as a photographer, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So what was the inflection point that you hit in 2019 that made you decide, okay, now I'm going to commit all of my time to the company and walk away from that other job?
Yeah, it was a hard one. And I was waffling for a while because I love photographing. And it satisfied a very extroverted part of me where I get to meet people and make their visions become a reality. But there were two parts. One was, in order to continue to grow as a photographer, I would have had to invest in, you know, like better equipment and start to grow my capacity as a photographer. But I was so busy investing every single dollar to my name and to the company's name in more spices that I couldn't invest in both. So I had to make a choice. And then the other one was the business finally got to a point where I could expense my rent. And the minute I could expense my rent, I was good.
I love that. You know, we all have to have those markers to tell us like, okay, this is the time. This is the direction we should go.
And I also, you know, I started expensing my rent somewhere in 2019, but I still wasn't making a salary. So Diaspora still wasn't like paying me a nice little, not even a nice, like a decent paycheck until the middle of last year. So I think September of 2020 was when I started making a salary off of Diaspora. So I'm very hesitant to make this story sound too romantic because romantic it was not.
And by the way, I fully understand. We started Who What Wear in 2006, and it was a couple of years before we were taking any money. I mean, I had to work side jobs for literally years because it just wasn't coming in, and whatever did come in went right back into the business. So for a lot of us, certainly for me, it just meant being scrappy for a lot longer than people had any idea. So thank you for being honest about that, because I don't think people always talk about that piece of it.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about supply chain.
Yeah.
I know that building a sustainable supply chain has always been at the core of your business. And by the end of the year, you'll roughly have 150 farm partners mm-hmm. and over 10,000 farm workers to whom you are continuing to expand health coverage. Tell me about this process, what it's been like, how it all works. It's so thoughtful and interesting. I just want to know more.
Yeah. So, you know, we started with Turmeric, and that has now been almost a 5-year relationship that I've had with Prabhu. And every time I visit him, I feel like I understand pieces that I didn't understand on my last trip. This time, I think I really understood how much his parents handing over the farm to him and saying, do whatever you want with it and build it however you want. It was such a unique thing where so many of the farms that we work with or we try to work with, the parents are often very resistant to organic agriculture or doing mm-hmm. things a different way. And so the kids who want to do things differently have no power and have no control. So I think part one of the way we build supply chains is, and this reflects to my very first trip home to India where I wasn't getting responses via email and I had to just show up in person, my big lesson was always show up in person. You know, you learn more. Business is done in person. That's how you build long-term relationships. And so at this point, half my year is in India and then the other half is here in the Bay Area. So I got back from my last trip, which was 2.5 months, 4 days ago. And so much of finding our farm partners is about values. It's about that first sentence that Prabhu said to me, which was that, you know, if you don't care about how I take care of my soil, I don't want to work with you. Like finding the farm partners that believe in the way of agriculture that is regenerative, sustainable, natural first, and then worrying about, you know, do they have the capacity? Can they scale? What is their annual yield? Like those are all questions that can be answered and fixed and developed with investment and with a long-term relationship. The key is really, are you values aligned? And like, do they have the same commitment to growing for flavor and deliciousness and quality that we want and that our customers have come to love us for? You know, our customers send us emails about things like, we didn't know that turmeric had a smell until we tasted your turmeric and smelt your turmeric. Like, we didn't know that nutmeg was supposed to do anything until we grated fresh nutmeg. Like, that's the
wow.
stuff we hear.
Oh my gosh, that has to be such an incredible feeling to know that you're opening people's eyes on one side of the equation and helping these family businesses on the other side of it. That just has to be so rewarding.
It is. And I think also connecting those two to each other. Like I send the product page of all of our spices to the farmers that grow them on WhatsApp. And sometimes I even hook it up with the Google Translate like plugin so that they yeah. can actively see the reviews that are coming in and understand what feedback is. And them being able to hear from, you know, some of the best home cooks in America and get feedback directly from them is a beautiful loop to create. So we want to find the farmers who want that and who are excited about that. So I've started developing this sourcing model of how we source and who we source from. And from day one, we've paid our farm partners an average of 6x the commodity price.
Wow.
And for some context, fair trade is considered a 15% increase on commodity price. So, you know, this is far, far beyond fair trade. And my belief, and I think it's been proven, is that unfortunately, given the hundreds of years of injustice that colonialism has kind of inflicted upon the spice trade, 15% just doesn't cut it. It doesn't help
yeah.
a farmer who's been systematically oppressed for 3 generations to climb his way out of poverty or her way out of
yeah.
poverty. But 6x, you know, is a start and starts to address that. So we, you know, just straight up paying more for their product was a big piece. And that's why direct to consumer was so appealing to me, is that if we're paying more to our farmer, we have to eliminate costs somewhere else. And if we can sell direct to our customers, then maybe we can make this model work. And that has proven true, and it does work, and customers love having that direct connection. But the piece that I think I was missing for the first 2 years was mm-hmm. realizing who owns the land and who runs the farm. It's usually men. 80% of Indian farmland is owned by men. It's usually upper caste Hindu men. Muslims and lower caste people don't get access to land ownership and are usually landless. And then as a result, even if you're paying a really high price for the product, the farm workers, which are usually lower caste, migrant workers, tribal workers, are still making, you know, below poverty wages. And in the tiers of class and poverty, they are still at the level where one bad health issue could knock them, you know, into desolate poverty. Or, you know, one kid being born with some form of a disability could completely change the trajectory of their lives. So I started really thinking about, well, what do we do about the farm worker thing? It would be very colonial and like patriarchal of me to, you know, and condescending to go to my farm partners and say, you know, this is how you have to employ your people. I can't change that system overnight by demanding things. Like, I have to understand the larger system that everybody's working within. So that's where we started tooling around with the healthcare project, is that I realized and I ran the math that actually to provide healthcare for 35 farm workers would only cost us $4,000 a year, which is nothing. Like, that's,
wow,
that's doable, you know? And so we piloted the program in 2019 with just Prabhu's farm, with just our turmeric farm. And then we expanded it to 4 farms last year. So it covered 250 farm workers last year. And this year, we're really hoping that we can, you know, take it to the next level. I'm currently interviewing people for a full-time social impact role that's based in India that can spearhead this project for us.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a real wonderful thing, but also something that I think will grow and evolve as we grow and evolve. There's a lot of wrongs that we need to right, and we'll probably do it in like bumpy, difficult, ever-growing way, but we're committed to doing it.
I mean, that's amazing. What an incredible life-changing project for your partners and their team members. I mean, that's really remarkable. So, okay, how do you know when it's time to expand? So projects like this are obviously one indicator that things are going well, but how do you know, okay, let's expand our offering, let's mm-hmm. start working with a new farm, let's open a new category? How do you know when the right time is for that sort of expansion?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think so far, there's been so much momentum around diaspora. And I always say that we have more demand than we have supply. And everybody is like, well, that's a good problem to have. And I'm like, it's still a problem.
It's still a problem.
It's still an issue. So, you know, the thing with our supply chain is that we're buying from small family farms. Some years they have an amazing harvest. Some years they don't. And like, climate change impacts that. And so with turmeric, for example, you know, last year, we bought a lot more than we're going to be able to buy this year because our partner farm just saw a lot of issues due to climate change, and the entire farm got COVID and they couldn't go to the field for a month, and that impacted their harvest. So we're now figuring out, well, A, how do we support them so that they can continue to grow? But then B, where else are we going to get turmeric from? You know, because we're reliant on this one family. And that's right. Where we're now realizing that we need multiple varieties of turmeric from multiple farms, which is a big shift from last year even. And similarly, like last year, we had way more demand for cardamom than we had supply of cardamom, because growing truly pesticide-free cardamom is really, really hard. And so this year, we're now working with 3 farms instead of 1. We're not going to mix them together. We're going to sell them individually. So, you know, you can buy this farm's cardamom or this farm's cardamom. So, you know, we're doing it in a way that feels right for us and still continues to spotlight our farm partners. And in terms of the growth of adding on more spices, man, I wish I could do it faster, but I'm just slow. Like, our customers have been shouting at us for years now, being like, where is cinnamon? Where is fennel? Where is cumin? And we're just like, we're working on it slowly.
But diaspora has 30 spices already. I mean, that's like a not insignificant number, right?
We do. The thing is that like, they go in and out of stock, you know, like right now, yeah. I think there's probably like 12 on the site because 18 are awaiting new harvests. And I think that's an educational thing that people haven't understood yet, that like spices come from a plant. When you're done harvesting, there's no more. And so I think we've come a long way since 2016 in explaining to folks that, you know, this is essentially a farm product that you're receiving. And when the harvest is done, it's done.
It's not an always on situation.
Yeah. And it's not sold out because we're bad at our job. It's sold out because we're good at our job and we only want to give you the best.
I mean, that's really interesting, the education piece of it, because I'm sure people are used to like walking in the store and
exactly.
The same things are always there. Yeah. But I also feel like that makes it kind of sexier because you don't know if the thing that you want will be there. And that makes a loyal customer and one who checks in.
I hear you. Yes, yes, yes. And I think initially a lot of my slogan to myself was that I'm going to make supply chain sexy again. And I think it's true that we've built this like cult-like following around things like pesticide-free cardamom or vine-ripened hand-harvested peppercorns that I don't think existed 4 years ago. There wasn't hype around these things. So yes, I think we have an amazing, very dedicated community that is starting to really buy into the way this works and the way the supply chain has to look like for the best quality.
So, Sana, what are your goals? What's next? What do you want to do?
Yeah. So first year in 2017, I was like, you know, we'll have all the spices within 6 months and then we'll have rice and then we'll have lentils and then we'll have oils and we'll just have this like empire. And like we have 30 spices and I feel like I've aged 30 years. So we do not have rice or lentils. But
yet,
I think we want to go deep before we go wide. So we get asked all the time, you know, why don't you source from all over the world? And I think my answer is always that my roots are in India. We're able to have phenomenal impact in India. We have a cultural connection so that we usually can speak the same language as our farm partners, which is huge. Next 5 years, you know, we have over 100 spices we still want to bring people that y'all don't even know about. And like Ooh. Sharing tribal ingredients, herbs, really going deep into our foraging and our sourcing to give y'all flavors from maybe all over the world. But for now, I'm going to say all over South Asia and the subcontinent. 10 years, we really want to show people how to cook with those things. And that's in the form of, you know, tangible spaces and cafes so that we're not just helping you cook better at home, but we're also showing you interesting, fun, super veggie forward, spice forward ways to eat those things outside of home. So my dream is cafes all over the world that are very regional and spice forward.
I'm so all about it. Let me know when that happens. I'll probably be following anyway. I will be there day one, just saying. Okay, so on this podcast, we like to acknowledge the fact that the skills that we are honing in the very early days of our career actually have great resonance and can be very helpful as we do other things in our career. So I'm hoping that you can tell me a little bit about the skills from your first life. Mm-hmm. In terms of photography, in terms of cooking, in terms of marketing, how they have helped you as an entrepreneur?
I think there's two parts. The first one is I learned how powerful visual storytelling can be and the power that it has to connect people to, you know, a brand, a product, a story. So telling beautiful stories around our spices has always been our superpower. And I learned that as a photographer and a marketer. As a line cook and somebody who worked in restaurants, just sheer grit, the ability to stand for 16 hours, the ability to get burnt all over and still show up and love your job. So much of running this business is about getting hit, shaking it off and moving on. And my partner is a rugby player and a very high level rugby player. And I think her life as an athlete and my life as a line cook were so similar in that like you get hit and then you get up and you do it again.
That is amazing. So we also like to talk about mistakes on this podcast because everyone makes them.
Yeah.
But not everyone wants to talk about it. And I feel like we live in this Instagram perfect filter mm-hmm. world where we just see the highlight reel and not the real reel. So I'm hoping you can tell me about a mistake that you've made in your career thus far and what you've learned from it.
Yeah, I think a big one for me was, you know, I was barely in a full-time job for 6 months before I quit and went on to start in Diaspora. So I didn't have a lot of experience as a leader, as an employer, as a boss, all of those words. And I maybe didn't understand that power dynamic. And I have seen myself as the underdog, as like the little kid, like trying to do something as the punk for so long that I forgot that like I was the leader and I had power and my words had power. And I think I've since really had to work hard to remember my position as the leader and that I have to lead by example and I have to be compassionate to the people around me and that the way that I see myself with all of my insecurities can actually be very harmful to an employee who doesn't see me the same way. So really honing my leadership in the past few years and coming to terms with my feelings with myself at the same time as being a leader.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are in their first life. They are interested in making a switch. They want to make a leap. They want to pursue something different. They want to go work for themselves or just in a different industry, but they're afraid on some level or haven't summoned the planning and the courage or whatever it may be to make that change. What advice would you give someone who's feeling a little stuck and needs that push to go after the thing that they really love?
Yeah, I think about this all the time. I mean, there were definitely days that I lusted for a steady paycheck, like, oh, the joy. But ultimately, like currently, I wake up every morning and I make up the answers to these big, challenging, daunting questions. And it's so tough and so fun and so just wacky. And I think that for folks that are, you know, in their first life, gaining the courage for their second life, I think it's that it will be really hard and you will give up a lot of the comfort of your first life, but there's so much fulfillment to be had. You know, you go to sleep tired but happy.
So my last question is also my favorite question, which is if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self, maybe you still in college, maybe you right after, and give yourself some advice, what would you say?
Yeah, baby Sana was so lost, had such low self-confidence. So I think big one is to start to believe in myself sooner. You know, the minute I did that, my life changed. And I just think about how much pain and hurt I put myself through because I didn't know my worth. And so I let people walk all over me. So, you know, letting my younger self just say, you are so, so worthy way before you ever know it or believe it.
That is so profound and so true. And I am so appreciative of your time, Sana. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
That was the founder and CEO of Diaspora, Sana Javeri Qadri. For more inspiring interviews with women like Sana, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show. So send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.